so excited to have this conversation. I have so many thoughts and questions for you. But the question I want to start with is, why do you have such a strong need to be productive? Now, I'm assuming in asking you that you do have a strong need to be productive. I think we're both like admitting that we do, but we want to talk about why.
Yeah, I guess I want to quibble a little bit about the terms. I think it's not quite true that I have a strong need to be productive. I have a strong need to be working, and I have a strong need to be proving myself publicly. But like when I think about productivity, I think about it like kind of in the sense that economists use the term, where it's like a lot of it has to do with quantity. And so, you know, one of the terms by which artists get praised is prolific, which is just bananas to me. I remember seeing a book years ago from a major publisher, and it said on the back that, you know, so-and-so has written more than 30 books of poems. I just thought, why is that a good thing? So I have something that I think has like roots in some of the same things as the desire to be productive. But it's not that I want to be producing a lot of stuff. It's that I want to spend a lot of time working on stuff. And then I want the stuff to be validated and valued in a way that validates me as a person, if that distinction makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And I think that's probably how I approach it too. Producing stuff for the sake of producing it doesn't seem particularly worthwhile to me anymore. Maybe it did when I was 10 or so years younger. I was very enamored of the early 2010s productivity genre. I was deeply into, as I've mentioned, this podcaster, writer guy called Merlin Mann, who at the time was kind of connected to this world. Now he's like totally disavowed all that. Even somebody like Tim Ferriss, the 4-Hour Workweek, I thought that was really stupid, but I was also like, what is he saying though? Like, is there something in there that I could use? I bought and read David Allen's Getting Things Done. I had lists. I had, you know, projects. I was completely addicted to the feeling of ticking things off. And it's not that I'm completely over that, but I think I kind of see now that the list only grows again the next day. Like, you never actually get to the end of the list. And also, I think the things that are important to me these days, like writing decent poems, writing decent essays, making podcast episodes that people actually like to listen to, that kind of stuff, it doesn't really lend itself to that kind of approach. Like, if you can't put on your to-do list, write a decent poem. So yeah, I think my relationship to productivity as productivity has changed quite a bit over the last 10 years.
So I have my own answer to this, but I'm curious to start with you. So when you were really into checking the boxes, what do you think made that feel good?
I think it was just basically connected directly to my self-esteem. Like, I think I only saw myself as a valid and like valuable person in the world if I'd done everything that I needed to do. And I decided what those things were day to day.
And that was true even if what you were doing was like completely invisible to the world, even if what it was like scoop the cat litter.
Yeah. And that probably would have made it onto the list because then I get to tick it off. It was pretty sick thinking in a lot of ways, but it kept me feeling safe and feeling valuable and needed. And like, I had a function. Glad to say that I think my sense of self is like a little bit more separate from whether the cat litter is clean or not these days. So that's nice.
I think, you know, there are two kind of, there's an external and an internal version that I, in my experience, have. And the external version has to do with validation and being able to show myself to the world. Again, even if the world's not looking, the part of the world that I've internalized, showing it. Mm-hmm. But there's also an internal version that's not just something I've internalized. And I've been thinking a lot. Holy fuck, does this sound pretentious? I've been thinking a lot about time lately. And it occurs to me that like time is a human medium. It's a human element. Like as much as air or gravity, time is the element that we move through. And for me, time can get baggy, it can get twisted, it can get accelerated. And one way of relating to that is poems themselves. Poems are a way of organizing time, of giving time shape, because they tend to have this kind of deep involvement in rhythm and pattern and those sorts of things. I think they have, with plenty of exceptions, they have a pretty intimate relationship with time. And so they're not just organizing ideas and feelings, they're organizing time. But I think also in general, for me, productivity, work, checking things off the list is also a way of organizing time. So a lot of times, if I'm at loose ends, I'll just start doing work, like work for my job. And it's a ridiculous way of, soothing myself, but it does soothe myself because it gives time a shape, and it gives it a structure, and it gives it, kind of going back to what you said, at least an illusion of progress. I'm moving towards something. And I think a big part of our relationship to time is making that motion seem purposeful or ordained or shapely or patterned. And so I do think part of my inability to just sit still and think or stare or look at something pretty is that I've become overly dependent on work as a way of warding off that looseness or blankness of time.
Yeah, and that actually reminds me of something that you've said a few times in different places, which is when you read a poem, the first question that comes to your mind, or one of the questions that comes to your mind, is what do we do with it? And I sort of hear you say that, and I'm like, what do you mean do? What do you want to do? But yeah, I mean, I'm pretty similar though. Like I will tend to just like start working, but I think I realized in the last couple of years, it's not good. Like, that's not like a positive, because there's no end to it, right? Like, there's no point at which someone is going to come to your door and be like, Alice Allen, we've noticed that you've been making very productive use of your time, and we've created this plaque for you that you can hang on your wall. Like, there's nothing
Or
coming.
we've put together this box of happiness that we will now bestow upon
Exactly.
you.
Exactly. Yeah, it doesn't actually get you closer to happiness. And yeah, I've been having to think a lot about, because like I don't know, I'm thinking about all this in like fairly extreme terms at the moment, because I've got two like fairly unhappy aging parents, and I kind of look at them and I'm like, what? That doesn't look good. Like I don't want to go there. And so I look at my life and I'm like, okay, so you're 43, so you've got like maybe 30, generously 30 years of sort of able-bodied, like compos mentis ability to like operate in the world. What are you going to do with that time? Are you going to just work? Are you going to just tick things off the list? Or are you going to try to like access some fucking joy like ever? And then I've had to like think in really concrete terms, like what actually brings me joy? And it is actually things like exactly what we're doing now. Like I love having quite deep conversations with people, and I like writing and I like publishing things, but it can't just be that, because that's too close to work. If this kind of feels like, maybe more than I realized before we started this conversation, this actually feels like kind of an urgent question, like how to spend the time, how to get the stuff done, but not how not to let the productivity eat your entire life.
One of the things that is kind of in the back of my mind with a lot of these things is the degree to which we need illusions to live meaningfully.
Delusions.
Illusions, hopefully, but probably delusions as well.
Okay.
I may have mentioned this on a previous episode. I had a professor in grad school who used to talk about poetry as serious play.
Yeah.
And I've always liked that phrase. I don't know if that was his phrase or if he'd gotten it from someone else, but so much of our recreation is different kinds of play, creating games to play, not just, video games, but yard games, karaoke, puzzles, whatever it may be. And I think writing has an element of a game, but it's a game that I can get to the end of, or at least the stopping point of, and feel like, oh, I've been doing something more than just diverting myself. And I think to some extent, when you and I are talking, we're making human connections. And I like to believe that that's more deeply human and rich than a lot of other ways we can spend our time. But also, as you say, we're working on something. We're working out ideas. And that, again, it's that sense of movement even there. It's that sense of composition, of moving towards something. I don't think you can go all the way with this, but I kind of think we need that. I think there's a need for the sense that we're making progress sometimes, that we're advancing something. And I think maybe there's a certain amount of self-deception involved in that. That's just inevitable.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it is self-deception because, I mean, yeah, you could say, well, what are you progressing towards? You're only going to die. Like, what, why bother? And that's pretty dark. Like, you don't have to
Yeah,
sort of,
one could say that.
you could say that. And yeah, that's probably the most accurate way to like describe human life. But I don't know. I don't know if it's an illusion necessarily to say creating something, whether alone or with another person, is like a pointless form of project of progress. Because like, well, then everything's a pointless form of progress because, you know, one day the sun's going to explode.
Some of the thoughts cross my mind.
Yeah, I mean, yes, like that's true. But I don't know if I want to go so far as to say then therefore it's an illusion that we're progressing because like we're progressing on our own within the terms of like our own human lives and like our lives within human history and yes, that's not actually a permanent thing, but nothing's permanent. That's always true. This is getting way too heady for 9:55 in the morning. Yeah, I guess all of which is to say like I share that desire to feel like I'm working towards something. Like Tom and I were having a hilarious conversation in the park on Friday night. Where he was like, but you don't like to play. Like you don't like playing games, for example. And I'm like, no, I fucking hate playing games. I hate board games. I hate them. Not only because every board game these days is like trying to do your taxes. There's so many fucking rules. He came up with the phrase, it's like playing mock Nuremberg every time you like sit down with a board game these days. But yeah, I also don't like the feeling when you could be sitting around like chatting with your friends and hearing about what's going on in their lives and like getting closer and building a connection that it's like, no, we have to talk about like what this piece does in this particular phase of the game. And I'm like, I don't care. I don't want to do that because it feels like it's not moving towards anything because you're only going to like finish playing the game and then it's over and we pack it up and it's like, oh, okay, great. Well, that was fun. Anyway, I'm a stick in the mud in this particular way.
Yeah, you're not invited to game night.
Are you like a board game guy?
I'm not a big one, but I do have a group of friends that we get together and play board games with, and it's like it's fun because it's them.
Yeah.
It's an occasion. Again, it's a way of like organizing the time and giving it some shape, and then like eventually, we're just talking shit and being ridiculous, but the game is like a pretext and
Yeah.
like sort of an underlying rhythm to the interactions. But no, I would never play a board game. Of course, I would never play a board game. I mean, that's how board games work. But like, that's not what I would choose to do.
But you're still going to do it, and it is like a totally, like there's nothing productive happening in that time except that you're getting to hang out with your friends and have fun.
But I mean, even if I step back far enough, and I have a bad habit of stepping back too far enough to fall off the edge of the cliff, sometimes I do say, start wondering, well, what is fun even for? And you can see why I'm so much fun at parties.
What is funny
But
before?
I don't know, it's so much of this is just getting swept up in something, and to some extent there's a lot of whistling past the graveyard, but better whistling past the graveyard than I don't know. I don't really want to play out the metaphor. It's not going to go well, but you get my point.
No, I do. I do. And like it is all your entire life is whistling past the graveyard. But like, yeah, you might as well whistle because you do have to be alive and you do have to like live in a human body and have relationships and like do stuff. And I don't know. Like for such a long time, I think I thought that that to-do list was going to save me from something. And then eventually, very slowly realizing that it wasn't actually going to change anything. And that if I wanted to get anything close to happy, I had to, it what the list wasn't going to be it. The list might make you feel satisfied for a short time, but that's all it can do.
You've said, when we've talked about this a little bit, not in a recording, that some of this feels very American to you.
Well,
That
yeah.
there's a kind of national quality to this. And as an American who, like most Americans, doesn't really know that much about other cultures, that sounds plausible to me, but I don't really have a way of confirming that. So I'm curious to hear you say more about what a non-American relationship to this stuff would look like.
Yeah, there's a few things to say on this. Probably the first thing to properly acknowledge is that in a lot of ways, Australia is little America by this point. Like you guys, culture, way of thinking, politics, geopolitical actions, all this sort of stuff, like it influences us to a huge degree, to the point that when I edit myself back on the show, and a part of this is because I'm like talking to Americans, and so I pick up your accent a little bit, but I'll hear my R's, and I'm like, oh, so you sound, you're saying R, sure. It's like, why are you doing? But it's like I listen to American voices most of the time. I watch American shows, American movies, music. Like it's all my whole brain is soaked in it, and my whole brain is soaked in. Like it would be a lie to say something like, oh, in Australia, we're the lucky country. We're super relaxed and chill. Everything's no worries, mate. Like, that's not true. And when I looked into this statistically, for some reason, something to do with Poetry Says, I found out that Australians, by some measures, work just as hard as Americans do, if not harder. We do have more holidays and we do have more like leave built into our work contracts, but not everybody even takes that leave. Like a lot of people just work all the time in the same way that you guys do. And I think that is part of just being part of like, we're a Western capitalist society. We're not like in any way separate to that or immune to that. And so I don't want to like overplay the whole like, yeah, Aussies are so laid back angle because we're actually not, actually not like that. But I think the difference, when I thought about it, I think the difference is that we are working towards an amorphous, maybe ill-defined, but still very convincing sense of the good life. Retirement, the beach house, the grandchildren, and like being able to just do whatever you want, caravan around Australia, like freedom. I think Australians, in their minds, are working towards freedom from working because they, and like I think a lot of Australians just forget to stop working or they get addicted to working. But I think that the difference is that Americans are working towards status. And that is the key thing is like Australians, to Australians, status is a very It's a very different thing. We're very suspect of it. You can have status, but you need to be very careful about how you display it and how you talk about it. Whereas with you guys, it seems like it is like, even being over there, people would ask me questions and I'd be like, that's a bit fucking rude. Why are you asking me like to account for myself? Fuck off. I'm on holiday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until you got to the status part of that, I was like, this all actually sounds pretty familiar, except that the likelihood that you'll get there is, I think, less plausible to more people here. The idea that you'll get to that good life where you can stop
Yeah.
working, that seems less and less
And the other thing that
real.
is important to kind of add to all this is like the social safety net aspect. So like you don't have to work to have healthcare, to have decent healthcare. You don't, you can stop working and the government will provide for you to a certain degree. There's like superannuation built into every single job that you have. Even if you work as a barista, you have super. It's like really high. The government intentionally made it high back in the 90s because they were like, we need you to be able to retire. So like all that's kind of built.
Yeah, and on the status part, to the status part of it, I haven't traveled internationally a lot, but when I have, thinking of being in Rome and being in the Netherlands, like one thing that seemed to be the case to me as an outsider, and I have no idea if this was the reality, it felt like in those places you could be a person who works at a cafe and there wouldn't be any anxiety around that. It's amazing to me how often I'll hear a kid say, "Oh, you're going to end up working at McDonald's." And like, obviously, there is a problem with ending up working at McDonald's because you can't fucking live off of that. But that's not what they mean. They mean you're a loser. You're not going to be a person worthy of respect. That is definitely something that I have internalized. I so fear in any job losing my job. And it's not so much the precarity of it, it's the humiliation of it. And so I do think writing, I don't think I know, writing has always had this sort of complicated presence there. Writing at a few moments in my life has given me validity. And boy, did I miss that when it was gone.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the thing that like we haven't brought up yet, but you used to write for Slate and you wrote for Slate when Slate was cool and you were the poetry guy on Slate. Like that must have been fucking so seductive and exciting and like so hard to give up.
I didn't give it up. It was, like it just expired, and I got a 4-year run with it that I in no way had earned, and have no bitterness about them not keeping me on for eternity. But yeah, it was a big loss. I think that's always there. I kind of chose to disappear from. Partly disappear from the public poetry world for a number of years. And I did a few things here and there, but like mostly I was just working on this book. And there were kind of two things going on at once. One was there was this huge relief in being able to just work and not worry about what anyone thought or, how this was going to be received. But at the same time, it also gave me years to build up all of these grand illusions about what I was doing and how fucking important it was and how like world altering it was going to be. So that, that's always there, but it's a lot more enjoyable when you can kind of close the doors and pull down the blinds around it, for me at least.
So the Slate role ended, and then you were writing the book that's going to come out next year.
There was a lot more time in between those two things.
Okay.
But yeah, the Slate role ended. I got to write criticism kind of regularly for the Kenyon Review for a while, and then that ended. And I had been running this magazine for a long time, and I got to the point where I just didn't have that in me anymore
This is at length.
at length. Yeah. And so that was becoming, instead of like something I could say about myself, it was becoming a source of shame. And then, there was just like lots of time on social media, which is just like so perfectly designed for my particular neuroses. I left that, and I mostly, I would write a review here or there for like a smaller publication, Usually I would just send it to someone who I knew would take it. I didn't want to have to like pitch and do all those things. And then I just was mostly writing this book for 5 years, and it was great. But part of the reason it was great is that I could imagine I was working on greatness because there was no one around to tell me otherwise.
And then you got to the point where it was finished and you needed to send it out, and there was like a scary period where it looked like it wasn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah, I was really like when we were planning this podcast, I was at a point with that where I was convinced that book was just not going to be published at all, or that if it was, because I published the one book of essays previously, and that was just a really lousy experience. We've maybe talked about that as well. And so I was convinced that either it wouldn't be published or it would be published in a way that would be very similar to that first experience. And so, I don't think I ever said this that directly to myself, but I think part of the appeal of doing this was to have something else I could make that would go out into the world and that people would say, okay, that seems to be a thing. Whether or not it's, a popular thing or a good thing, you can just say, oh, well, he made a thing. It was almost like going back to the productivity model.
Okay. And yeah, just to say, I've read that book, the essay collection, that Peculiar Affirmative. It's beautiful. It's totally beautiful. And I don't know anything about, like, I didn't even know. This is how clueless I am still, even after like having sort of 5 odd years being connected to American poetry in a particular way. I didn't even know that like the Kenyon Review was like such a big deal. I was like, yeah, that sounds, I don't know, it sounds like Jane Kenyon. Is it important? I have no idea. But it's like a big fucking deal. I now understand. But yeah, to me, I got my copy of that book, your essay collection, and I didn't know who the publisher was, but I didn't feel like I should have known who the publisher was. And I just read it plainly as it's a beautiful collection of really great essays. I guess all of which is to say, like, to me, everything you do looks like a perfectly good, like, success, because I don't have a deep understanding of like the status of the various things that you're doing. I mean, I obviously know that like Slate's a big deal.
You know how all this works. Like, this is just making you into like the club that would have me as a member that I no longer want to join.
How do you
I mean,
mean?
I still want to be your friend. Just like the moment you start saying nice things, I'm like, oh, well, that's not worthwhile. Like, that's just
Oh
more illusion.
God, that's
Yeah,
harsh.
sure. I mean, that's not about you. I hope you understand. Like, but that's the illness of seeking status.
Yeah, and I wanted to kind of talk about that from the Australian angle too, because I don't want to make it seem like we're somehow immune to that or that we don't care about status. I think we do care about status probably as much as anyone does, but we have to be more subtle about it. You can't get something and then look like you are posturing about it or reveling in it, or you think you're good because this happened. You have to downplay it. You have to, like, it's a very complicated little game that you've got to, little dance that you've got to do.
I think we play that game at least in parts of America, including the American poetry world. I suspect we're just not as practiced with it. One thing that I would always see on social media is like somebody would be like, I'm honored to have this published or humbled. So you know, the humble brag is I guess the term for it. But yeah, you always have to be in that posture. But I don't know that we just I don't I just don't know that we're very good at that posture.
Yeah, okay. And even like, I'm not saying that you're humble bragging, but even every time the role with Slate is brought up, you're like, yeah, but I didn't deserve it. Like, I just got it because I was lucky. And it's like, yeah, but you're skipping over the bit where you're a really good writer. Like, what the
Okay, well that's nice, but like, and you're right, I absolutely don't want to talk about that. But like, I mean, I'm also not kidding about it. Like, I had no qualifications. What happened was my friend was an editor there, and I had like never written a review. I don't think I'd ever written a review of a book. And my friend, instead of doing the responsible thing and giving it to someone more qualified, which also might have meant giving it to someone who was not a straight white guy, gave that role to me. I'm not just deflecting there. Like that actually is a reality. Like I feel like, yeah.
All right, fair enough. Fair enough. I'll let you have that one. But back to the status, like having that posture of, oh yes, I'm very honored. You know, I'm very lucky to have this thing. Maybe Americans and Australians are closer in that than it might seem at first. But I do still think there is a pretty profound difference. Like the word loser that you brought up earlier sort of is behind that comment, oh, you're going to end up working at McDonald's. Like, I don't think that word is thrown around in the same way over here. Like, to say, oh, you're just a barista, what a loser. That doesn't really make sense. It's like, is that person happy being a barista? Then great. Like, that's good for him. Like, that's awesome. It's sort of like you're a loser if you buy into any sort of prescribed ideas of, you know, success and status and you're going to work your life away. Like, that's the loser move. Being a surfer and just, I don't know, like living in a rented house in Byron Bay and getting to surf every day. Like, that's pretty, if you're enjoying that, like, nobody would look at that and go, oh, what a loser. They'd be like, fuck you, you got to live in Byron Bay.
A lot of my students are closer to that way of thinking, in part because they're just so much more cynical about any kind of institution. And like, boy, if they had, I mean, you know, if you think about what their lifetime has been,
It's
they have
like,
every reason to be cynical.
yeah, welcome
And
to
at
the
the same
world. It's
time,
9/11.
yeah, well, they're younger than that. They don't
Oh,
remember
right.
that.
They don't even remember 9/11. Yeah.
No,
No.
but I think some of the things that they remember are
GFC.
the pandemic
Yeah.
when we like closed schools and kept bars and restaurants open.
Really? Did you guys do that? Fucking
Oh yeah.
psychos. What the hell?
And they remember George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and nothing changing. They've been hearing about climate change since they were kids,
And
and they've seen nothing change.
no one does anything
And
about it, yeah.
then also, like, they're seeing that, you know, the promises that were always partly illusory or were illusory for some people, that if you worked hard, you would get these material advantages and have this kind of security. They're saying that that's just not what's happening for a lot of people anymore.
And that you can cheat your way to the top, and that if you have a friend in a high place, you can just get whatever it is you want.
Or even the idea that you could work your way to like a comfortable life. I think that's evaporating to a large extent. And then, you know, like I think social media is such a flattening technology that it all like they sometimes, not all of them, but they sometimes are just don't see any point in institutions. That doesn't make sense to me as, you know, the old crotchety. I'm like, well, no, we need to be able to have ways of working together and, you know, some stability to get things done and whatnot. But I think for many of them, it's not even burn it all down. I think they're
It's like, don't
that
even
would be
bother to
like,
burn
it's like,
it.
yeah.
Yeah, just walk away.
So I do think there is an aspect of that, but it's interesting because it's happening without the safety net that you all have.
Yeah, it's terrifying. It's a terrifying thought to not,
I
yeah.
really, I mean, we're pretty far away from poetry right now, but yeah, I really fear that many of these kids will like just never be able to get their heads above water.
Yeah, I don't know. I also don't know how to bring the conversation back around to poetry.
Yeah, sorry. I think we've gone way too far afield.
I mean, like, it is about like productivity and how you spend your time go to how do you spend your life, which goes to why do you spend your life that way, and is that even worthwhile? So yeah, it's a pretty big thing. I keep thinking about this movie that I watched recently called The Worst Person in the World. Have you seen this film by any chance? It's a story about a girl who lives in Oslo. And so, yeah, she's got that like Scandi safety net around her. And that is just like a given within the film. And it means that she's able to pursue like 10 different careers before she's 30. She's got this one relationship with this guy, but then she kind of starts a relationship with another guy, and there's a bit of overlap. And the whole movie is asking you to decide, is this girl the worst person in the world because she's really indecisive? She makes decisions that are actually pretty selfish, and they're based on what she wants, what's going to make her happy. And I'm thinking about this film as we're having this conversation because it's built into the fabric of it that she's not making any of these decisions because of status. She's making them because she wants to live a happy and good life. And not to spoil too much of the film, but one of the things that underscores this is that one of the characters that she's close to gets like has terminal cancer. So that kind of like throws everything that she's doing into this like extreme, puts it in this extreme light. But I watched that film as an Australian, and I don't think she's the worst person in the world at all. I think she's just pursuing happiness in a very sort of understandable and comfortable way. But I wonder, to an American audience, does she look worse because she's wishy-washy? She's just going from one thing to another as she feels like it. She's not really pursuing anything straightforwardly connected to status.
That sounds like a person who would be very frustrating to me. Certainly not the worst person in the world. We have far too many competitors for that title in the United States. But no, yeah, I think that person just sounds, and this is like, I'm not trying to justify this, but just to like define the way that like my particular mind works, which I think is a fairly American mind in this particular instance, is that person sounds selfish to me. It doesn't feel like the person is trying to find any way to work based on anything other than their own pleasure. And that feels very peculiar to me, and kind of flighty and unserious.
Which probably gets to the question of what's under the productivity. Like, what are you producing? What are you working for? What's the reason? Are you working for some idea of improving the world, making the world a better place? Is it to make your own life better? What is the thing under the drive to produce and work? Or is it just whistling past the graveyard? Is it just like trying to stay in the illusion that you're moving forward in time instead of just towards a dead end?
Yeah, but it's a particular kind of song that you're whistling. It's one with, I'm not saying this makes it better, but it's one with more, it's one that involves more presences of other imaginations and other ways of making music. I think it's probably a richer song that you're whistling, even if it's still an illusion, when it's involved in making something that has some kind of discernible value beyond yourself. And again, like that's to try and wrestle this back to poetry. I think that is something that's really, for me, elemental to the pleasure of writing is the ability to believe that I'm doing something that is valuable, and value being defined by other people. Which in some ways is chasing after something out of your control, but in other ways, recognizing who we are as humans. There is something fundamentally social about us, and there is something deeply pleasurable about doing something that seems good to someone else or for someone else.
It's interesting though, because it seems to me like you have a pretty strong sense of the illusion. Like, you know it's an illusion, but you're also willing to participate in it.
I do and I don't. I think I'm much better at controlling my mind than I used to be, so that awareness or belief or whatever it is mostly intellectual. It's not an emotional belief. Like it's more like my belief that there's no free will. I never experience an absence of free will, even though I believe there's no free will. And I think I've gotten to that point where I can mostly do that with my sense that all of this is an illusion. It's an illusion that feels consistently real to me now.
Maybe what I'm trying to ask is a little bit sort of more prosaic than that, but I guess what I'm kind of wondering is like, because that the your illusion that your work matters eventually has to hit reality. And what I suppose, for lack of a better word, I'm worried about is like,
Me
what if,
too.
yeah, like what if?
Yeah.
Like, how much validation is enough?
Never. There's never enough. My
Fuck,
professor
Jonathan.
would always talk about it as like success, artistic success is cotton candy. You know, it just dissolves in your mouth, but it doesn't make you stop wanting cotton candy. There are ways you can bolster it. The like hopes that are reading and teeming when I'm writing, I when I'm actually like putting something out in the world, I try and turn those as close down as close to zero as I can, and to always have something else to be working on as soon as that thing's done, so that I can say, well, oh, that was a failure, but this thing's amazing. There are all kinds of defense mechanisms that go to
Yeah.
work on it. But yeah, I mean, I generally feel better when I'm writing than when I'm not writing. And I generally feel better when I have written than when I haven't written. And part of that is inseparable from my ability to feel that I'm making something that other people will value.
Yeah, that other people will value. Yeah. Yeah. But I guess what I'm trying to ask is like, is a project a failure? If you don't get, like we said last week, the merit badge, if you get no merit badges, is it worth having done it?
Yes. Yes, because it's part of the learning process. Yes, because it made my days better. And I'm a petty and self-indulgent enough person that, you know, I can sometimes just decide that everybody else is an idiot. And in fact, it was great anyways. And I've just been screwed over because poor little privileged me. So, yeah, no, absolutely. But there's also a sense that this one needs to be different. The next time it needs to be different. It's not that I regret the time spent on it. It's that I feel a little bit humiliated.
It's a lot of pressure.
But as I get older, the balance between those things shifts. You know, it used to be all seeking validation and no pleasure. And now it's a lot of pleasure with bouts of failing to achieve validation.
And you also got this like high dose validation treatment when you were in that role for Slate. Probably you were like kind of the age that I am now, right? How long ago was that? Like 10 years ago?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably ended in my early 40s.
And started when you're late 30s? Yeah. I mean, that's fucking deadly. Like just
Yeah.
being that particular age, like you're out of that early 30s, like anything's possible. And you're into the late 30s, early 40s of like, okay, we're gonna double down and get this thing. And then you're in this, like, you're getting sort of fed this
And
uncut.
too, like I have a lot of ambivalence about the writing I did then. I can see what seemed to me like pretty serious flaws in it. You know, I can't help thinking, oh, well, that I got a lot of validation for that. Not because that's the best writing I'm capable of, but because that's the writing that had that masthead on it.
So the validation itself isn't even like, it's not even valid.
Yeah. But, you know, there's probably some value in that kind of cynicism as well. Almost certainly helps me check some of my approval seeking and hunger for validation.
Yeah, this is tough territory, isn't it? It's like actually quite, it goes to some quite sensitive places. I was trying to talk about this a little bit. The other day, I just recorded like a little sound file that I put up on my Substack, and I was talking about how poisonous the whole like love hearts thing is. And also in Substack, you've got open stats, and you've got like who clicked on what link, and how many people have like opened this thing. And I was the same with my poetry says stats to the point of sometimes being completely insane about them, like, and trying different ways to like figure out how other podcasts were doing and how I was doing in relation to them. And one of the most upsetting things about it was like none of the stats are reliable when it comes to podcasts. Like you can't actually measure anything, even though people sell you stuff and being like, yeah, they'll tell you exactly when people stop listening. It's like, yeah, I don't know.
But also, like, these technologies are so sophisticated and so good at using us.
Yeah, that's they're made like pokey machines, yeah.
Like, even better than poker machines at this point. Like, they were like poker machines 5 years ago. They're like poker machines that are also like injecting smack into your arm now. But, I try not to be sentimental about art. I try not to be a cheerleader for art, but I do think one of the potentials of art, one of the potentials of poetry in this moment is that they have the potential to confound that. Art is always has an element of consensual exploitation, but it's not that kind of machine.
Yeah, Substack will try to make it that kind of machine pretty quickly though, like as well as, but yeah, no, but I did have a really lovely comment from someone on something that I wrote the other day that was just like, I usually skim things, but I actually read this. I was like, that's so nice. Like, come on, that's the fucking best.
I actually put my phone down while you were talking to me.
Like, that's nice.
That's how much I love you.